Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Legends, the greatest social casino experience has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.
From the start. David, welcome to the chaos. How are you?
Stephen, hopefully you guys can hear me at this point.
This is such a relief. You sound beautiful, David. This is wonderful. What a time to be alive.
Leading with the right foot anyways. So
maybe you could tell us a little bit about your Cold War channel.
Yeah. So my name's David. I'm the host of a YouTube channel called The Cold War. The basic mission statement is to do a recount and are telling the story of the Cold War, which is basically the period from the end of the Second World War, sometimes a little after, sometimes a little before, it depends who you talk to, up until 1989 or 1991, or there's quite a lot of debate that goes on in terms of how long the Cold War actually lasted. Lots of people argue that it's still going on today. that's a whole other podcast. I'm happy to come back on and have that argument some other time. Every Saturday we release a new video on a new topic, basically looking at some really big episodes, some really big incidents that happened, some cultural aspects from either life in the Soviet Union or cultural impacts in the United States. And then other weeks we do pick sort of smaller topics and try to explore and dig into things that hopefully we can do a little bit of education and teach people with something that dispel a couple of myths, something that might not have known about that period from 1945 to 1991. So
it's a fascinating period. It's a bit of a thorn in my backside because I'm somebody who's very skeptical of conspiracy theories and people trying to get away with things. And I reject a lot of them out of hand. And then people will bring up the CIA and all the nonsense they've tried to get away with. And I have to hold my hands up and say, yeah, you've got me there. They really did try some quite out there zany stuff, and chief amongst them were, you know, attempts to assassinate Fidel Castro. So what can you tell me about that period of time in terms of the political climate and why they thought this was potentially a good strategy?
A bit of groundwork. I mean, Cuban Revolution happens in 1959. Fidel Castro overthrows Fulgencio Batista, the U.S.-backed dictator that had been ruling Cuba for quite a number of years. And the U.S., which had had massive, massive business and political interests in Cuba since at least the Spanish-American War at the turn of the century, the U.S. took that rather personally. There was a lot of, and that's putting it mildly, there was a lot of senior, very influential American politicians and businessmen that lost an awful lot of money when the Cuban Revolution happened. There was like scores of nationalization of the sugar industry, of shipping, telephones, you name it, across Cuba. It was basically this slow process of nationalization and throwing the U.S. out of Cuba. And when all of this started, Washington basically took this very personally. The Dulles brothers, Allen and John Foster Dulles, who were head of State Department and head of CIA, who had business interests through United Fruit and whatnot, and lots of their buddies and those around them took a very great interest in hopefully being able to remove Castro, who they saw as being an unfriendly item to the U.S. And wanted to remove him from power.
Unfriendly item. I like that. I'm taking that, David. I'm going to use that in my day tomorrow at some point.
The first one's free, Stephen. So, So what ended up happening is, even under the Eisenhower administration, so before Kennedy took before Kennedy won the election and took power, the Eisenhower administration was already working on plans to see what they could do to, if not remove Castro, certainly discredit him in the minds of Cubans so that the Americans could get back in. And this very much stems from this idea that the CIA was, and the CIA is the group that they turned to, because the CIA had a decade-long history at this point of international regime change. Regime change is, I think that's more of a common word that we use in the here and now, as opposed to in the 50s. But 1949, as early as 1948, 1949, the CIA in its very earliest form after it was created was attempting to overthrow government in Albania to no success. They had success working with the Brits to overthrow the Iranian democratically elected Iranian president Mossadegh in Iran. 1954, there was a Guatemalan coup that was backed by the CIA, and it's really the Guatemalan coup that that sort of sparks the CIA's hubris, I would say, in terms of thinking that it could basically do whatever it wanted, especially in its own backyard. This wasn't Vietnam, where they'd helped to install Ngo Dinh Diem. This wasn't Iran. This was 90 miles off the coast of Key West. Like, this is really is like literally their backyard. And it sparked all these different ideas that resulted in claims from the Cubans, mind you, but claims of over 600 different assassination attempts on the life of Fidel Castro. Over his life. Not all of those are by the CIA, naturally. There was a lot of people who may have wanted Castro dead, but the CIA certainly had their hand in more than a few of those. So there's a bit of background anyways.
Yeah, that's great. And there's lots that I want to unpick from there. But you said something interesting there, this idea of regime change and how, you know, Western powers would often try and, you know, enforce and enforce these kind of things. But in a sort of post-Iraq climate now, as the USA and the CIA lost all appetite for that kind of things, certainly in such a direct way.
Sorry, David, I'm having sound problems on my side now. There's the not that I want to get into this, it's completely on my side. There's the condo block that I live in hasn't had any yard maintenance in a month, and they're deciding to use the leaf blower today. So my apologies.
This is because you've started talking crap about the CIA, and they've just
They're listening. They're everywhere. So,
in all fairness, I imagine it must be irritating for you being there, but we can't really hear it so much, so it's not ruining the audio.
I'm glad that you're not able to hear it.
If you can persevere, we'd be very
absolutely
grateful.
If you could just ask the question again, I'll do my best to press on through. It seems to be certainly the afternoon of this.
So I think I asked in terms of regime change in a sort of post-Iraq climate, does the CIA in America have very little appetite for that kind of thing going forward now?
I will probably beg ignorance on the current state of that. I consider myself to be a historian. I like to work with sort of the documents and the things that there's proof of. Do I think that the CIA involves themselves in things in regime change to these days? I think that they're a part of that. They're a part of America's security apparatus. They're a part, like, you know, in terms of promoting their own interests. But what they're doing now, I don't want to, for fear that they might show up at my door or something. I would not feel comfortable comfortably, definitively stating that yes, they're absolutely out there causing havoc across the world and, you know, replacing governments. But there's
really
certainly,
historically
speaking, there's a long, long history. To indicate that, why would anything be different now? So
yeah, okay. I mean, that really would ruin the show tonight. We've had audio problems, video problems, and if you was to be assassinated live on feed, I think that would ruin my day, David.
Think of the ratings, though.
This is true. Okay, I mean, tell me a little bit about the Cold War period in terms of why it fascinates you so much. Of all the periods of time people like to focus on historically, why is this one so important to you?
Cold War, I was born in the late 70s. I grew up through the 80s. I mean, that's the period, the what we now can refer to as the late Cold War, because we know that it ended in 1989, 1991, whatever you want to call that. But at the time, like, you know, as a kid, like, it was, you know, you wake up every morning knowing that the alarms could go, like, you know, you could get the, I mean, 4-minute warning if you were in the if you were in the UK, or like, you know, 15-minute warning if you were in North America, that the Cold War could spark off at any time. That was just, that was the environment, and that was the life that everybody lived, and it was that you automatically lived under, and there wasn't going to be a change to that. It wasn't, I compare it to something like the Second World War, which has this sort of this fixed notion. Even during the Second World War, people knew that there was going to be an end to it. In the 80s, the Cold War seemed this indefinite. It was never going to end. And that, yeah, looking back on it, that fascinates me. I played a lot of video games. I read Tom Clancy books, and a lot of those things use the Cold War as a, like, a historical backdrop. And you sort of absorb all that into your, becomes a part of who you are and what you're interested in. That sort of has carried forward, and why part of the reason that we do the channel. Coming back to Cuba, I've been to Cuba several. I'm a Canadian. We don't have travel restrictions in terms of, you know, direct flights. I can. It's cheaper for me to go to Cuba for a week than it is for me to fly to London. Believe it or not, that's just the way that these things
probably
work.
Probably cheaper for me to fly to Cuba than get the train to London from where I am, and that's not necessarily a joke.
And it'll probably be on time, no less. So
yes, yeah, for sure.
So I've been to Cuba a few times. I've been to Santiago de Cuba, which is where Fidel is buried. I did a tour of the city, and without even knowing it, we ended up at a cemetery, and you're walking through and following the tour, and there's Fidel's grave right there. So it's all these little things in my life that sort of seem to come back around and sort of indicate that, yeah, there's this recurring theme in my life that I find. Cold War places find me, I find Cold War places. I don't know exactly how that works out. It's also, in my opinion, it's a rather underserviced period of history in terms of education and knowledge that's out there. There's a lot of myths. There's a lot of half-truths that are out there. A lot of that has to do with access to sources, because so much of that is classified or redacted to such a degree that it really is hard to know what the truth is. Like yourself, I'm not one that's prone to conspiracy, but I can understand why it can happen, because you do a FOIA Act like request, and you get your Freedom of Information papers, and half of it has been marked out, and it's, you can't read it, and your brain starts to fill in gaps, and you don't know what your brain is just filling in gaps with maybe what the truth is, or maybe what you want the truth to be. And it's fascinating to sort of delve into this and sort of start picking different threads and different pieces from history and sort of threading it all together. So it really is like this amazing period of history to me. So the fact that I was there at the end, like, you know, sort of like, you know, you watch that on television as the Berlin Wall is happening. You watch the Soviet flag being lowered over the Kremlin for the last time, and the Russian flag being raised in its place. It just seems like that was the 11 o'clock news at the time, but in retrospect, it's like, wow, like, we're really watching history sort of unfold. So
when was the fall of the Berlin Wall? Was it 1989?
November 10th or November 11th, 1989.
So. I remember that. I have an early memory of, I was born in 84, but I have a memory of like a children's show in the UK. And this might be a false memory. I'll have to look this up later, but they were actually giving away pieces of the Berlin Wall as prizes.
Yeah.
That seems like something far too crazy to have just imagined myself.
No, I mean, I completely believe that there were hundreds of tons of concrete that the wall was made of. It was the entire city of what was West Berlin, not just the dividing part in the middle, but like obviously like all the way around, was concrete, this like massively thick concrete wall. Leave it to capitalism that within hours probably of the wall starting to come down, there were probably people starting to collect it and reselling it. There's lots of people have pieces all over the world, and some people have more authentic pieces than others. That's all I can say to that. So I myself have never collected a piece of the Berlin Wall. Maybe I'm not trusting enough to put they can be surprisingly expensive. And I'm just not trusting enough to put down a few hundred pound to get a piece of the Berlin Wall that may or may not be authentic. So
yeah, it's always a risk. Okay, you said something interesting there. I mean, you said, you know, this living in this climate of the looming 4-minute warning and how real the threat of nukes were at that time. And nukes are a sort of part of the current cultural zeitgeist, again, with Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer, which chronicles, obviously, the Trinity test and the Hiroshima bombing, which, unless I've missed something dramatically, was the last time a nuke was actually detonated. And I often wonder, given, you know, the proliferation of nuclear weapons, how many there are, almost feels like a sort of Chekhov's gun situation where you feel it's not a matter of if, but when, even just by accident. I mean, tensions rise all the time. You know, we currently, parts of the world are at war right now. Nuclear superpowers are, you know, aggressive saber rattlers, etc. How likely do you think it'll be that we will see the detonation of a nuke in like foreseeable future? Just a nice cheery question for you to run out there.
I should put a drink. I should put something a little stiffer in this than just a cup of tea. It is absolutely no small miracle that we are all standing here now in 2023, and there has never been a nuclear accident that has resulted in an actual detonation. I mean, we've had Fukushima Daiichi, we've had Chernobyl, obviously, is the big one. There's numerous other nuclear disasters that have happened around the world. Those are really the big ones. I mean, I think Sellafield, Three Mile Island, there's several around the world that are on this sliding scale. It's a very small miracle. There's numerous incidents that happened in the US, certainly there's 36 what's called broken arrows that happened in the US where I can't think of the exact wording that the Department of Defense uses, but it's the unscheduled release of a nuclear weapon.
My God.
And one of the more famous ones, and sort of the one that always springs to mind if I get this kind of question, was Greensboro, North Carolina. I can't remember what type of bomb it was. I think it was a 4-megaton bomb that was jettisoned from a crashing B-52 that had had an air-to-air refueling accident. There were four safety solenoids that were like basically live warhead, sealed pit, nuclear weapon. It was the first three safety features failed, and it was a 50-cent solenoid valve that prevented basically like a huge chunk of North Carolina from being disintegrated. There's been several other nuclear incidents that have happened that are well known. There was a release off the coast of Spain near Palomares, that ground is still contaminated to this day. It's not a nuclear detonation, but there's plutonium dust and whatnot that gets scattered. Tybee Island, in Georgia, there's several incidents like this. And it really is just a small miracle. And then that's only the training accidents. Then you move to what happens, like if there's somebody, one side misunderstands what's happening on the other side, and somebody decides that, yeah, now's the time. When I say 4-minute warning and 15-minute warnings, for those who may not be aware of this, the 4-minute warning, that's how long it would take for an ICBM launch from the Soviet Union to obliterate the United Kingdom, was 4 minutes. 4 minutes from launch to detonation. 15 minutes from the USSR to the east coast of the United States. 15 and 4-minute warnings, but that's what you would get. Reaction time on that is not very high. There's not a lot of time to sit and deliberate how long like each side is gonna be able to respond. If the idea is that your side, your team A, and I'm not gonna pick sides here, but if you're team A and you see that team B is launched, you only have a few minutes to decide whether you're going to launch as a counterstrike. And a lot of this has been computerized, as we've just seen with the previous host. Computers mess up. I was going to use a stronger word there, but computers do mess up. There was an incident in 1983. Cut me off at any point if I'm rambling, but
this is both illuminating and terrifying. So I'll let you know when I'm ready to cry.
Perfect. 1983, there was an incident where a Soviet early warning system detected a partial launch from the United States. And the commander in control, Stanislav Petrov is his name. He's also been dubbed the man who saved the world. Stanislav Petrov made the decision that there was only 200 missiles showing being launched, which didn't make any sense because there were thousands of missiles. If the U.S. was going to launch a strike, why would they only start with 200? So he refused to even call it in. He refused to authorize counterstrike. Turns out it was a computer glitch. It was, I think that's the one. It was reading the radar system was reading the sun rising above the horizon as a launch. There was an incident. There was an incident in the state. At least a couple of incidents in the states. One of them was somebody loaded a training tape onto a live computer. It was a simulation tape. So suddenly, like out of nowhere, it looked like a full-scale launch from the USSR against the US. And it was only somebody actually using their brains and like sort of critical thinking decided like, no, this doesn't make sense. Discovered it was a training tape. There was a flock of birds at one point. It is an absolute miracle that we are still standing here right now without some sort of an accidental detonation or launch. I'm a big proponent of non-proliferation. I shouldn't say I'm a big proponent of proliferation.
Nukes for everyone. You have a nuke. Yeah, exactly. You have a nuke. Yeah.
The only good country with, you know, the only way to stop a bad country with a nuke is a good person with a nuke. we'll take that to its logical conclusion. I'm a big fan and a big proponent of proliferation. The fewer countries and the fewer groups that have access to nuclear weapons with strong safeguards in place, the less likely there is that there's going to be some sort of an accident, some sort of intent, whatever that happens to be.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Legends, the greatest social casino experience has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.
The more nukes that there are and the more groups that have them, the more likely that chance increases. To answer your original question, now that I've been rambling for a few minutes, statistically speaking, it will happen because that's how the law of averages works.
Yeah, that's where I am with it, and that's terrifying. And this is one of those rare situations where I've actually been quite annoyed how knowledgeable the guest is, because it's just not made me feel any better, David. But this idea of mutually assured destruction is one that we seem to lean on a lot. This idea that we won't nuke you because you'll only nuke us, and we're basically pressing the button ourselves to be nuked if we nuke you. But I mean, a while back, I don't know if you're familiar with the American neuroscientist and philosopher Sam Harris. He wrote a blog post about this, about nuclear first strikes, and a hypothetical situation, but he envisaged a situation where perhaps an Islamist regime might acquire nuclear weapons, and to somebody like them, who would get dewy-eyed with the promise of paradise, I think how he put it, the idea of mutually assured destruction wouldn't mean anything to them. As a matter of fact, they'd probably invite it. Is that something that you've thought about, something you've worried about, in terms of it really depends on the ideology behind the people that have the nuclear weapons?
It does. So much of nuclear strategic thinking that's been developed since Trinity, and certainly has advanced immensely as the power of the weapons has increased and as the nuclear stockpiles increased. So much of the base assumptions is that the groups in control were rational thinkers. And that everything is predicated on the idea of of rationality in terms of decision making. And I think Sam Harris is bang on. As soon as, and I'm not going to pick on Islamists, because it could be religion, it could be chemical imbalance. I mean, there's a wide variety of different things that could present. But as soon as rationality is taken out of the decision making process, nuclear weapons are not a rational weapon. Like, that's just at their fundamental core. They are fundamentally destructive, especially at scale. The U.S. and I was going to say the Soviet Union, because that's where my brain sort of all my bookshelf is over here, and like every second title has something to do with the USSR. Both of those sides. What was I talking about? Rationality. Rational thinking. So much of that is predicated on this idea that you want to live in, like, you know, there's a win condition, because the win condition exists. And that win condition, if you've seen Dr. Strangelove, it's, oh, yeah, you know, because there's 20 people in a mine shaft, and, like, you know, because you have 20 and the other side has zero, you've won. Like, but that's, as messed up as that is, that isn't necessarily rational thinking. Rational thinking is the idea that your culture overall, your society can carry forward. Nuclear weapons are all destructive, like, in when they're used as the strategy dictates that they will be used, which is all or nothing. And that's basically how war plans, flexible response, which is something else that we could talk about. Flexible response doesn't exist. There's always an escalation to move to. It could start with, like, you know, a baby nuke on the battlefield, and that's going to escalate its way up to the big boys. That's just the way that's always going to work, because the military mind takes over, and it's, you know, it's basically we need to achieve that win condition. As soon as one's been used, that Pandora's box has been opened. It's not a rational weapon. It's all destructive, and nuclear weapons will, if used in a hostile manner, will wipe out the world as we know it. The Earth will, this is what I keep trying to tell my kids. The Earth will survive. It's just that we won't be here with it.
Yeah, a great name dropping of Dr. Strangelove there. I'd reckon if people haven't seen that in the chat, it's one of Kubrick's best, I think. And for a satirical comedy, essentially, of that age, it stands up really well, strangely. It could have been written yesterday.
Incredibly well. I know Hat Green Nuclear Bunker outside Manchester, for those of you in the UK, they do occasional screenings inside the bunker of Dr. Strangelove. So I'm going to name drop Hat Green there.
I live in Manchester, and I think I've been on the tour.
Yeah, that's check the website. Occasionally, they do occasional screenings of Dr. Strangelove, which I would, perversely enough, I would love to attend. That would be phenomenal. So
yeah, there are two nuclear bunkers in Manchester that I'm aware of, and one allows tours, and the other one was bought out by a phone company that uses it to now run like hundreds of miles of cable around. So yeah, somebody did break into it once on 7/7 of all days, when London was under attack, which is not the day you want to be breaking into high security facilities.
No,
for
not
sure.
Really.
No. Did you watch Oppenheimer? Did you see it?
I did see Oppenheimer, yeah.
What did you think?
I enjoyed it. I'm not, without getting into the whole my movie opinions, I'm not the biggest Christopher Nolan fan.
Oof, that's the most controversial thing you've said today.
Well, I could say something even more controversial. I could say that Barbie was a better movie. Can I talk about Oppenheimer? Like, I don't want to spoil.
I think we should move on. No, I'm only kidding. Go ahead.
I don't want to spoil it. I don't want to spoil it for anybody. As a movie, I like the stories, and there's two stories that Nolan's telling. And I think that he's trying to tell too much. He's got two stories running in parallel, and he didn't manage to merge them together well enough to my personal satisfaction. I would have preferred either a story of making the bomb or a courtroom drama.
I have exactly the same. So I'm a massive Nolan fan, but I've been quite lukewarm towards a lot of his later efforts. And I felt like, because it was building up to this big moment of the Trinity test, you know, the tension was racketed up. It was a beautiful moment. And then there was another hour of like courtroom drama-esque material, and it just felt a little bit deflated. I feel like he should have just gone the whole Tarantino route and you know, changed the ending and actually had the Trinity test cause the Earth to explode. That would have been quite poignant and interesting.
It just would have been feet being incinerated at the end.
Yeah.
It's Tarantino, so.
For sure. So, I mean, moving back to Castro, you said something like 600 assassination attempts.
Yeah, so that's the Cuban Security Services claim. Like, by the time that Castro passed away, there'd been 634 separate attempts. The CIA has only ever been confirmed as being involved in about 7 of them. So Operation Mongoose, which I think was when Ash had first reached out to me, it was to actually discuss Operation Mongoose, which was going back to Kennedy and Eisenhower. That was the U.S. plan to discredit and to remove Castro. And that very much started off as with this idea of discrediting him, like, you know, of discrediting Castro to the point that the Cuban people wouldn't be in love with him anymore and they would overthrow him and, you know, the U.S. could move back in and everything would be back to happiness and casinos. And we'll come back to casinos in a second because that's really, really important to the story. Early plans involved putting like thallium salt in Castro's shoes, which thallium salts are a depilatory. They'd make his beard fall out. And you know, that's his Castro's beard naturally had magic powers. So as soon as he was, you know, the Cuban revolutionaries, like the guys who had like Raul and Cienfuegos and Fidel, those guys, they were colloquially known as Los Barbudos, which in Spanish means the bearded ones. And the CIA really latched on to beards in terms of trying to, like, you know, it's like take away Castro's allure, and cigars. They tried to provide botulism. It was botulism laced cigars, so that the cigar would either make him very sick or kill him. They tried to arrange to gift him a scuba, like a wetsuit, a diving suit, with that was infested with like fungal spores. That would give him like an all over body rash and make him unable to go out in public and, you know, it's like deal with the people because he would be like terribly disfigured. They tried gifting him a scuba tank that had tuberculin bacilli to give him tuberculosis and kill him over the long term. As these sort of plans got more and more outlandish, they considered planting an explosive seashell in an area that he liked to go diving. Castro was a huge aquatics guy. Like, he loved to go scuba diving and snorkeling. But that was the thought, that they were going to put this really attractive shell that was laden with explosives. And then when Castro went to pick it up, it would explode and kill him. That never actually went anywhere. And then Bay of Pigs happens in 1961 and fails spectacularly in a really, really big way. And it's a huge, huge embarrassing moment for the United States as a whole, but especially for the CIA, because that was very much a CIA-backed plot. And that's the part of that talk about hubris that I was mentioning earlier, where there's this idea that the CIA could do anything, and whatever they attempted to do, they would obviously get success because they were American and they were the CIA. And then the Bay of Pigs fails spectacularly for a very wide variety of reasons. I'm going to plug the channel. We have a really good episode on the Bay of Pigs. Please go to the Cold War channel. Check that out if you're interested. But the CIA basically started changing its tactics after Bay of Pigs. And it involved actual real wet work. And that involved like straight up assassination attempts. And one of those assassination attempts involved trying to smuggle in an actual like a sniper rifle, and have a willing agent in Cuba assassinate, like straight up, like just shoot Castro dead. The gun and the money and everything went on their merry way and never turned up, never to be seen again. That's the recurring theme in this. But then the CIA cottons onto this idea that, what other interests in the world would have be curious to get rid of Castro? And one of the big ones that they cottoned onto was the mafia, the organized crime in the United States. And so using an ex-FBI agent as a cutout, the CIA reached out and they were put into contact with three separate men. To begin with, it was Handsome Johnny Roselli, who was a big Vegas mobster. Sam Giancana, who was a Chicago, head of one of the Chicago families. And through them, they were also put into contact with a man named Santos Traficante, who was a Spanish-speaking part of the mob, but also very much involved with the mafia and with Cuba and the Cuban community and the exile community in the south of Florida. And through this, they started trying to arrange various various assassination plots, pills, and they were really big into the pills. And they were trying, they had a couple of different plans where they were going to try to sneak pills in to a subversive agent that was working in one of the restaurants that Castro liked to visit. And at each stage, something happened and it was foiled. Each of these plans that the CIA, that we know of, that the CIA was directly involved with, some sort of chance, happenstance, something fell apart and it didn't come about. And then, you know, Cuban Missile Crisis happens in October of 62. And then following that, Bobby Kennedy and JFK were both taking Cuba incredibly personally. Bobby Kennedy especially. Bobby Kennedy finds out that his brother, the president, is having an affair with a woman named Judith Exner, who was a girlfriend of Sam Giancana, who's the mobster. And they find this out because Judith Exner keeps calling the White House to talk to the president. And how that all came about is you can't write this stuff. Like, this is the truth. The truth can be stranger than fiction. And it all sort of comes about that the Attorney General and Bobby Kennedy knew that the CIA was illegally tapping, placing wiretaps in the United States, which they're not allowed to do. That's FBI territory. The CIA is only allowed, by law, the CIA is only allowed to operate extraterritorially outside the United States. So there's all these like circuitous paths that seem to cross and come back and forth through the whole thing. But following Bay of Pigs, not Bay of Pigs, following the Cuban Missile Crisis, they really start to pull back a little bit and there's some reconsiderations, like, you know, what are they doing? They know that a full-scale military invasion is no longer possible because they've made that promise to Khrushchev in exchange for not blowing up the world. Seems rather important at the time. And what we were just talking about. And this just sort of goes on. And then what your earlier guest was talking about, then JFK is assassinated. And as soon as JFK is assassinated and LBJ takes over as the presidency, JFK had no interest in Cuba whatsoever. He was far more interested in what was happening in Southeast Asia and in Vietnam. And basically within the space of months, LBJ has wrapped up all the Cuba operations and squashed them, like basically told the CIA no more. And all the CIA stuff is pushed under the rug and it's all sort of covered up and, like, you know, they close the files and walk away and they all go get involved in Southeast Asia. Until the Church Committee hearings start coming up in 1975. And these are open Senate hearings looking into American Security Service oversight and overstep, looking at all the places where the CIA has overstepped their mandate, just gotten way past what they're actually supposed to be doing. And that's when a lot of these assassins, like the actual proof, and there's testimonial proof and documentary evidence that the CIA was involved in all of these things. It's kind of a wild story. Like it really is a bit of a roller coaster. And I'm giving it really short shrift here, and I do apologize. I'm just looking at the time, and I think I've only got a few minutes left in terms of the time slot. But it really is just some really crazy, crazy stories. And I have a corporate job. And you keep hearing the corporate world loves, like, you know, out of the box thinking, blue sky thinking. This really was like CIA, like a bunch of, like, you know, these are spooks, like sitting in a room coming up with, like, what are some ideas that we can come up with? And it's exploding seashells. It's, you know,
let's talk about the wackiness of it, because these are supposed to be the greatest minds, you know, the clue should be in intelligence. And the assassination is a very serious business. And some of the ideas they come up with, would it be out of place in say, like an Austin Powers movie or some sort of James Bond spoof? Is that wacky? How have we got into the situation? I mean, is it just the value of hindsight because they were treading new territory, or were they really just completely off the chain mentally?
The wackiness of a lot of these ideas comes from a conscious awareness of the agents that were involved in the planning. It was a conscious awareness that the Cuban people weren't particularly interested in removing Castro. They were never going to get a popular revolution to overthrow Castro. Castro had come in and removed a hated dictator. He was introducing education and healthcare, trying to end racial discrimination. You can have there's an endless argument that can happen in terms of what the long-term success of all that is. But in the early 1960s, that's what he was coming in. That's what he was doing. He took a population that was had four, like a 40% illiteracy rate. And I think Cuban literacy rate in the present is like 99.9%. He was a popular guy. There was never going to be a popular revolution. Didn't matter if his beard fell out. It didn't matter if he had like a bunch of fungal spores all over him. Like that wasn't going to make a difference.
Well, David,
and I think that's where a lot of this, and so like the wackiness idea is like, well, you're not going to get a popular revolution, which is what they had tried to trigger somewhat successfully in Guatemala. It was never going to happen in Cuba. So you start thinking like, okay, well, what can we come up with? And that's where you start coming up with exploding cigars.
Well, David, you are an encyclopedia on this topic. And I honestly feel like I've been schooled in the most interesting way in this conversation. I will check out your channel for sure, because I will no doubt learn so much. So maybe you could just let people know where we can find more of your content and output on this issue.
Yeah. So it's thank you very much, Stephen. I really appreciate the effort, the opportunity to come on and just talk for half an hour. Most people, including my wife, told me to shut up a long time ago. So the channel is it's on YouTube. It's just The Cold War. If you type in The Cold War into the search menu, hopefully that comes up. We've been on releasing videos every Saturday for 4.5 years now, I want to say. So there's 250 plus videos. If you do start at the beginning, their production quality is maybe a little rough. Some of the newer stuff is a little cleaner. It's a little prettier. I think I'm a better host now than I certainly was then. But yeah, please check us out. I read all the comments, especially the bad ones. It's a hellscape. Please come check us out. Learn a little bit about Cold War history. We take requests. We don't always listen, but we do take requests. So that's us.
David, this has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for speaking to us. I've learned a lot, for sure.
Pleasure was all mine.
I appreciate it. All the best. Take care. Take care.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Legends, the greatest social casino experience has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.
Do you love true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries?
If so, you gotta check out our podcast, True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everybody's watching.
We say everything you're thinking and probably screaming at your TV.
We've been at the top of the podcast charts for almost 9 years, and we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone's talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.